Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the Occupy movement with Russell McIver, the editor of The Corporate Crime Reporter and author of On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. We will discuss whether the closure of some of the Occupy sites across America will diffuse the movement's message about how the 1% have bought most of our politicians, who in turn have sold out the 99%. Then we will look into the latest sex scandal ensnaring Herman Cain's presidential campaign, with the fifth woman coming forth with accusations of a 13-year adulterous affair with the candidate whose exit from the race will benefit Newt Gingrich, a confessed adulterer who has sought redemption from the religious right, the group that dominate the Republican caucus in Iowa. Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief Adele Stan joins us. She has been following the Tea Party and their favorite son, Herman Cain, who denies the latest charges unequivocally as he reassesses his campaign. Then finally, we will examine the apparent repeat of history in Tehran, where this time the British Embassy was sacked by so-called students, calling it a den of spies, this time chanting death to England. Dan Brunberg, the author of Reinventing Khomeini, The Struggle for Reform in Iran, joins us to discuss this violation of international law and assess what the fallout might be as Western powers turn the screws on a paranoid and isolated theocratic regime. I'm now speaking with Russell McIver, who is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Russell McIver.
Thank you, Ian.
And you have been at the Occupy Washington, D.C. sites, but I understand that I'm using the word plural. Is there are two different Occupy sites in D.C.?
There are two different ones. And one's on Pennsylvania and 14th. The other's up at a park a couple blocks away. And two different scenes. The one down on Pennsylvania Avenue is much more active politically, more grounded in the anti-corporate movements of the last 20 years. Doesn't want to be co-opted by the Democratic Party. Is very wary about Democratic Party operatives infiltrating. The other one, mostly younger people, a lot more homeless people, more steeped in sort of street anarchism, and more susceptible to being hijacked by the Democratic Party. And I think there's been serious attempts to do that up at that other site. So really interesting how it's shaking out in D.C.
Well, I spoke with Kevin Zeese the other day, and of course he was Ralph Nader's press secretary and ran as a Green Party candidate, and he was quite angry about the what he said was the Democratic Party's attempt to co-opt the movement. What evidence is there that the Democratic? I mean, I still. I'm reminded of Will Rogers' adage about the Democratic Party. You know, I'm not. It's not an organized.
Yeah, I think some of the evidence is from people I've spoken to have been there that when there have been disputes about challenging Obama, challenging Democrats as being the party of Obama to being the presidential candidate of Wall Street, even still this round. And there's also been, I mean, Kevin has more information than I have, but I've just learned by hanging out there a little bit and by listening to people who've been there that there is real tension between Democratic operatives on the ground at that site and, people who are not, who don't want anything to do with the Democratic Party. And I know that, in fact, there's a tension like that throughout the country. And I noticed it even I live in West Virginia, and there's an Occupy Martinsburg, West Virginia, and I noticed that tension even at Occupy Martinsburg, West Virginia. So I guess it's going to play out, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, the interesting thing to me is whether Occupy Wall Street is going to save Obama next year. And I think the Democratic Party is banking that it will at least help do that. After all, he is, you know, taking more money than any candidate the last round from Wall Street, and it looks like, you know, he's going to be taking a lot of money this round from Wall Street. If you look at agency by agency of the public sector in Washington that's supposed to be controlling corporate power, each one of them is acting as they acted or worse than under the Bush administration. So if you look at most recently, let's say the SEC's civil settlement with Citigroup, which was just shot down by a federal judge in New York, that kind of settlement is no different from a Bush administration SEC settlement with Wall Street banks.
Well, it took a judge to do the people's business and to bring about some justice.
Right. So, you know, it's really it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out. But a lot of the people in the Occupy movements around the country are very wary of being hijacked in this election year by the corporate Democratic Party.
Well, at this point, though, we've had New York, the Zuccotti Park being evicted, and now the L.A. Occupy LA. It was a semi eviction, and now there's a rumor that tonight there will be the final stage of an eviction. I'm just wondering how the movement's message about how the 1% have bought most of our politicians, who in turn have sold out the 99%. It seems to me that that's an extremely valuable political message to get out to the rest of America, particularly to the endangered middle class. And it does transcend the parties. What's your sense of whether that will?
Where does it go in an election year?
Right.
What are our options in this coming election year? We have none. So I guess the only option is to continue to hit the streets and continue to raise the banner, if the press will continue to listen. My guess is they won't. My guess is they're going to shift the attention. That we've had our 15 seconds of fame, and they're going to shift the attention to the battle between the two corporate parties.
But that's always been the way. The press are interested in process.
Yeah. So the question for the people on the ground is, how do we? I think there might be a parallel. I was thinking about this today. I don't know if this is going on a limb a bit, but it might be similar to Egypt, where the secularists take to the streets while the Brotherhood takes the election. And in this country, it might be that we take to the streets while the corporatists take the election. And I'm worried about that. Clearly, we have not developed a deep, strong political operation that will knock off the two political parties, to our eternal shame. Here we have the most we have in our hands, in each of our hands, the highest form of technological communication, access to information instantly. We can reach everybody, all of our compatriots all over the country and all over the world. We can see breaking news instantaneously, and yet we can't get 1% in the polls, and yet we can't fundamentally change the political system. So,
but why not? What about?
We have to look inward, and I think re-examine what's happening here, because we should. We're nowhere. We've effectively failed to make a blip or a dent in challenging the political power. Occupy Wall Street has, but in terms of straight out political power, we haven't. Now there are those who speak, who are in the forefront of speaking about Occupy the Occupy movements who say we should give up on the political system. It's corrupt. It's gone. And there's nothing we can do about it. We just have to push it over. But what does push it over mean?
Right.
In this context.
Well, I think the reality is that
undefined.
Yeah, I think the reality is if you abdicate the political system, the worst possible people will control it. And not that it's pretty bad as it stands. Again, I'm speaking with Russell Mahiba, the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter and the author of On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. I just wonder, though, Russell, whether since the Tea Party, even though it was a phony, turned out to be a phony grassroots movement, albeit there were a genuine impulse there amongst many of its members, but it was corralled by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey and funded in part by the Kochs. But they did take 60 seats, and they were politically, they went straight for electoral power, and they got it, and they've essentially hijacked the Republican Party. Why can't a group of progressive insurgents take over this corrupt Democratic Party?
Well, there are some, like myself and Zeiss, who say that the corrupt Democratic Party is too far gone, and we wouldn't want to carry their banner.
But the game is rigged.
I understand what you're saying, though. There are others who believe, like Norman Solomon and others, who believe that that it can be done.
Well, realistically, the system in this country is a two-party system. It's entrenched. It's a huge road to hoe to establish a third party. Only a billionaire like Ross Perot had a chance at that. It just seems to me unrealistic. It'll take time.
Well, it might seem unrealistic, but you know, here's something that's always in the back of my mind. We have the communication skills. We have the technology. We can reach people. We can go door to door and present our message. But something's missing. There is something missing. I don't think it's just about the money and the power. I think there's something missing about the way we present the message, the way we've delivered the message. Now, this might be a different situation now, where the 99 versus the 1 has gotten a lot of publicity and might lay the groundwork for something better. But to me, it still hasn't been argued conclusively to me that an attractive candidate, Tommy Douglas, you know, I do a group called Single Payer Action, and there's the most celebrated Canadian, Tommy Douglas, got elected to be premier of Saskatchewan. And got pushed through single payer through that province and then through all of Canada. Mm-hmm. Now, true, they have a different system up there, but it was about he was a boxer, he was a preacher, he was a populist, and he fought for the working people. And it was a different time, I agree, but we might be coming into a different time. And it might be that if we refine our ability to deliver the message and we go door to door, and we hit the streets, we can start anew, precinct by precinct, and start turning the country around. So I'm not one to throw in the towel on electoral politics. I don't believe that the door is closed and that we've lost it. I believe that, you know, we have to look inward and see how we can make it work, and this might be a time to do that.
Well, Barney Frank, as you know, Russell Mahiba just threw in the towel and is retiring. And in his back and forth, in his farewell banter with the press, he was asked about the state of politics. And he, in terms of the Republican Party, he basically said, look, you know, the Republican Party is divided into two groups, those that think like Michelle Bachmann and those that us terrified that if they don't go along with the program, Michelle Bachmann will run against him in the next primary. So that party has lost its mind.
That's true, but I would also argue that the Democratic Party is divided into two groups: those who think like Obama and those who refuse to stand up to him. I mean, it's pretty shameful that there's not one progressive Democrat who threw their hat in the ring to at least challenge Obama in the primaries in the year of 99 versus 1.
So,
in the year of 99 versus 1, you would think there would be at least one primary challenger so that he wouldn't continue to move to Wall Street and carry the cash without even thinking about it, without even debating it, without even, you know, having any shame about it.
Right. If there's anybody, it's on the Republican side in the form of Ron Paul. I mean, at least he's challenging some of the status quo, even though his domestic vision is pretty black and bleak.
I would urge people to start anew,
right,
to discard both parties, to hit the streets with Occupy, and then hit the precincts and start talking about the very basic issues. Keep it simple, 1 versus 99. Get rid of the private health insurance companies, death penalty for the private health insurance companies. Very simple messaging. You don't need big treatises. You don't need working papers. You don't need working groups. The message is simple. People are being pushed up against the wall. They'll be receptive to it. And I say we start anew.
Well, Russell McIver, again, the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter and the author of On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. What, given that the Occupy LA is about to be evicted, I just wonder about the continuing the messaging. I spoke to one of the founders of the encampment down here the other day. Mm-hmm. And he said it was really depressing to try and keep the idealism of those that founded it together and constantly being infiltrated by all the street people and the junkies and having their food stolen, et cetera, and actually portrayed a fairly dystopian picture and also the difficulty of getting anybody to agree to anything because the General Assembly by nature was an endless debating society. So... given the power of the simple message that, and frankly, so far, I think, wouldn't you agree that that they've gotten pretty good press? The 99% versus the 1% is out there in the zeitgeist, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this has been a huge victory for the anti-corporate forces, and this is the kind of press that we've looked for all these years. And I'm fearful that that's going to be it, that it's going to be our 15 minutes of fame, and that's going to be it. So we have to be ready to transform the energy to start building real political power. I think everybody agrees we haven't done that yet. The question is, what next? And I would encourage people to, you know, go out into the streets, to attend these general assemblies, to participate, but also to keep an eye on the future. And the future is this coming election year. And what can we do to transform it, to tip it over and to start something new?
Well, I thank you for joining us, Russell.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Russell McIver, who is the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with the Washington Bureau Chief of Alternate, Adele Stand, talking about Herman Cain's latest sex scandal.
Try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief Adele Stan, who writes for the AFL-CIO Now blog. She has served as a columnist and blogger for the American Prospect Online and as a featured essayist for The Guardian's Comment is Freeside. Her most recent article at Alternet is Do Allegations of a 13-year Adulterous Affair Spell Doom for Herman Cain? Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan. In your latest article, you have pointed out that unlike Newt Gingrich, who with his three marriages, two of them which ended in adulterous affairs, he in 2007 made a confession on Focus on the Family's James Dobson's radio show.
Right.
Who incidentally recently honored the deadbeat dad of the year, Joe Walsh, Congressman Joe Walsh, as a champion of family values. But
there you go.
I digress. Newt Gingrich confessed to adultery, which is, of course, one of the Ten Commandments he violated, but he was given redemption. And I guess the point here is that the Republican primary in Iowa is dominated by evangelical Christians, that means that Herman Cain is toast, right?
I think so, because he's not repentant. See, if he had come out and said, oh, I've done this terrible thing and I am confessing before you and before Jesus and before all of, and I ask forgiveness. You know, that is the Christian story, and you know that is such a centerpiece of how when you go to evangelical services where they do altar calls and people are seeking a conversion experience. I mean, they basically go up and do a public sort of confession of, you know, how their lives were broken, and confess their sins, but Cain is completely unrepentant, and yet he is an ordained Baptist minister. And I just don't see how he can possibly survive in the evangelical states, and two of them are very early, as you mentioned, Iowa and South Carolina. Their primary comes within several weeks of that. And he already blew it in New Hampshire by really standing up the editorial board of the Manchester Union Leader, which went on to endorse Newt Gingrich. So,
but by the way, he stood them up because he didn't want the editorial board meeting videotaped, which
right.
which is common practice. And it was the videotaping of his disastrous meeting before the paper in Minnesota, was it?
It was actually Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, right?
Wisconsin, yes.
And where he couldn't figure out what had gone on in Libya.
Right. So I do think that, you know, Herman Cain. I mean, there's, I keep thinking there's going to be someday a great ballad of the Herman Cain because if you look at his life. I mean, this is a guy who has surmounted really incredible odds all along the way and been quite successful. And he had this long tail of success, rising to the upper echelons of corporate America as an African-American who came from out of the Jim Crow South. I mean, that is just an astonishing kind of a personal story. And then he's had all these different careers at which he's been pretty successful. And he survived stage 4 cancer. But it seemed like humility, his lack of humility is what in the end is going to take him down.
Well, obviously this is the fifth woman. The first could have been dismissed as some kind of smear, as he suggested, but the second, the third, the fourth, and now the fifth, it stretches credulity. But she went public, Ginger White went public on Atlanta's Fox 5 But Atlantis Fox 5 had already received a tip about this affair, and apparently other news outlets already had.
Right.
It'd be interesting to find out who the tipster was. I mean, doesn't take a huge conspiratorial leap to think maybe the Newtster's involved here. No, of course not. I mean, I don't know that at all, but it just slipped off my tongue. What can I say?
Right. And, you know, I mean, and the tipster apparently presented him or herself as somebody who was close to Ginger White. Mm-hmm. So we don't even know whether or not, you know, Ginger White, gave her, permission
sure.
to the tipster or not for reasons of her own. But nonetheless, apparently she's credible enough that Herman Cain's own attorney gave a rather non-denial denial in the statement that he gave to the Atlanta news station, Fox 5, is basically not denying that there was an affair, saying that if there was one, it was really it was nobody's business.
Right.
It's not a matter between Herman Cain and Ginger White.
Right. Well, there's a good chance, surely, Adele Stan, that L. Lynn Wood, Cain's attorney, probably asked him, as I'm sure Clinton's attorneys in the early days said, are there any more bimbo eruptions on the horizon?
Mm-hmm.
And he probably said no. So I suspect that Lynn Wood, more than anything, is covering himself and his own credibility, isn't he?
That would make sense. That would make total sense to me. Because it's very kind of an unusual circumstance where you have a political candidate absolutely denying, as Herman Cain has, a circumstance in which his attorney says, well, if it did happen, it's really not any of your business.
Right. The reason I suggested the idea that maybe there was somebody behind this tip, Adele Stan, is the simple fact that all of these campaigns have people or even a division euphemistically known as opposition research.
Oppo, yeah.
An oppo. And you'd think that it wouldn't take any kind of gumshoe to do the shoe leather on this one, surely, to find out that Herman Cain, it gives a whole new meaning to 999. I got nine women in Georgia, I got nine women in Tennessee, and I got nine women in South Carolina.
It's like an old blues song. Yeah, I mean, it's really quite amazing. But the thing that I think and you're right, I mean, they seem to have been rather public. I mean, they dined out and, he took her on trips and all this kind of thing, according to her account of things. So it doesn't seem like, there would be any way to keep it secret. And Cain himself presaged that when he warned that other women would come forward to accuse him of things he'd never done. Well, I mean, that's not a standard fare for people to announce that there are going to be other accusations coming, but just don't pay any attention to them, But the thing about Cain, I mean, I just think he's a fascinating character in that, he really seems to have felt the need to try to get away with things. And yet he's surely a person of considerable personal resources in terms of tenacity, and he's certainly intelligent despite his lapses on foreign policy and whatnot. Those sorts of lapses seem to have been hubris. He didn't feel like he needed to know this stuff.
Well, he sure is a hell of a lot more interesting than that sort of rather crazed woman in from Minnesota, and the pay or play Texan, and the pay to play Texan, or the nasty mean the world's highest paid historian from Georgia.
I know a few historians who wouldn't mind making that kind of joke.
And the boring corporate automaton, you know, it's a pretty dismal feel, and he sure as hell is making it interesting. What did you make the Adele Stand again, Washington bureau chief for Alternet? What did you make of the Barney Frank's exit, referring to the Republican Party? He said, and I thought, it actually probably makes sense, and it's awfully depressing if it's true, that the Republican Party, in terms of the people on the Hill and in the Senate, are either think like Michelle Bachmann, or they're afraid that if they don't go along with Michelle Bachmann's program, somebody will run somebody just like Michelle Bachmann against them in a primary.
Well, I think I think the latter is more the case, and that's what. When I first started writing about the Tea Party movement, and you were kind enough to have me on the show when I did start writing about the Tea Party movement a couple of years ago, I mean that was the thing that I was trying to tease out, was that they don't need a majority because of the way that they have used threats of primary challenges. So they don't really need a majority of people who think like them. They just need a majority of people who will vote like them out of fear. And I think that Barney Frank is on the money about that. I really do. And I do think, it's going to be quite a loss to have him no longer in the Congress.
But isn't that the MO of a lot of the big powerful lobbies in Washington, D.C., AIPAC, the NRA, and Grover Norquist, where you threaten people in the primary with, if you got a Democrat who is not playing ball with you, then you run somebody further to the left of them. And if you got a Republican incumbent who's not going along with your program, you run somebody further to the right of them in the primary?
I think it's an old political game. I mean, we've seen it for decades. However, I think that what you saw with the Tea Party movement and with the involvement of the Koch brothers in organizing the Tea Party movement was that it became systematized in a way that included a ground game that hadn't really previously, it had been done by the religious right through the organizing evangelical churches. But never before had you had the right turn out into the streets in the way that you had the big Tea Party march through Washington in 2009 and all of these very raucous rallies on Capitol Hill. I mean, what they did was they took a page out of the playbook of really of the left to create a street presence that they never had before. So that's rather terrifying, where on the one hand you have the institutional pressure coming from the lobbyists and the people who hold the purse strings, but you also have this kind of, apparently grassroots army that is going to show up on your doorstep if you don't do what pleases them. And they also did a brilliant job looking at the Senate and how to control the Senate with a very small number of their own kind centered around South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint, because the rules of the Senate allow so few people to gum up the works. So, I mean, I think that what you're talking about is, yes, it's an old strategy, but I mean, it's an old tactic, but they applied new and very efficient strategies to deploy it in a way that really frightened party regulars into seeing things their way.
Well, that's what's so interesting about the Republicans, in the sense that they're a minority party, then they gain majority control, and with that, the only way that they ever get majority control is they get Democrats to vote for them. And they sure as hell, the party that brought us the Wall Street crash, turned around and profited from it via this kind of front group, this repackaging of the far right of the party known as the Tea Party.
Right.
And they captured that outrage. The previous guest before you came on, Adele, I was asking him about the Occupy movements and whether their energy will translate into political activity in 2012. And as you know, they've already had a profound effect within the political zeitgeist by putting through this notion, I think, that's quite pervasive, the 99% versus the 1%.
If that's their messaging.
Yeah, if it's their only achievement, it's an awfully big one just at that. But I'm afraid it doesn't look like there's going to be any such symmetry on the left like there was with the Tea Party capturing, 65 House seats or something.
Yeah, well, they're not focused.
But they're hostile towards the Democratic Party. At least a lot of them are, you know.
Right. And on the one hand, that's quite understandable when you look at the Wall Streeters around Barack Obama and the fact that the finance industry has had profound impact on both parties. I mean, even Barney Frank was hardly pure. In that regard, he was not always the most progressive on financial regulation and the like. So, I can understand from an ideological point of view how that is, but also I think that this has long been a conundrum of the left, where sort of the popular sentiment is not really married to an electoral strategy in a way that is really intentional about winning. You have an ideological movement, and then you have a whole sort of institutional structure, a liberal institutional structure that is focused on electing Democrats, and the two don't necessarily play nicely together. Where the right has been very focused on an electoral strategy that starts at the level of dog catcher. They've been doing it for 40 years, taking over school boards, and
right,
and that's how they took over the party.
But I think there's a psychological difference there between the political activism on the right and the political activism on the left. I think on the left they tend to be much more self-righteous and faint-hearted, and the right don't care about ideological inconsistencies. They're much more focused on power. They're much more disciplined, and they're much less easily disappointed, shall we say.
I think that's true. I think that's true. You'll hear lots of grousing, behind the scenes among right-wingers about so-and-so not being quite, anti-choice enough or whatever. But they will make sure that that person gets elected if it's a choice between that person and a Democrat. Absolutely.
Well, Adele, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Bye-bye. Bye. Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's Alternate's Washington Bureau Chief. She also writes for the AFL-CIO Now blog and served as a columnist and blogger for the American Prospect Online as a featured essayist for the Guardians of England's Comment is Free site. Her most recent article at Alternate is Do Allegations of a 13-Year Adulterous Affair Spell Doom for Herman Cain? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Brumberg, who is a professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University. He also serves as senior advisor to the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, where he focuses on issues of democratization and political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world. His books include Conflict, Identity and Reform in the Muslim World and Reinventing Khomeini, the Struggle for Reform in Iran. His most recent book is U.S. Policy and the Arab World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Brumberg.
Thank you very much.
And clearly we're having a kind of deja vu here and a repeat of history where the this time it's the British Embassy that was sacked by the so-called students calling it a den of spies, and this time shouting death to England. The British have suggested or threatened a vigorous response. What do you think that response will be?
Well, I really don't know. I don't think the Brits are ready to go to war with Iran over this. Will this be a prelude to a complete shutdown of diplomatic relations? Possibly. Even that would surprise me. So we'll have to see what they have in mind. Expulsions of Iranian diplomats on their side, some tit for tat, perhaps. But I don't think it'll go beyond that. On the one level, it looks like the hostage crisis with the United States in 79 or 80 all over again. But, of course, it's really not. They stormed the embassy. As far as I know, they haven't taken hostages, and I'd be very surprised if anything like that happened. But clearly, the Iranian government had provoked this because they're very unhappy with Britain's most recent support for further sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, it followed the parliament voting to downgrade the diplomatic status with England, and the vote was overwhelming, and the MPs apparently chanted death to Britain. So when the British say there are going to be serious consequences, it does seem, though, that the screws are being tightened. And I don't know what's going on in terms of covert activities or a kind of cold war. But I understand that Iran lost India as a major customer for oil because the banking transfers, it's more and more difficult to transfer to actually pay for the oil. Is that their Achilles heel?
I think so. I mean, I think the most recent series of sanctions really address the kind of economic jugular. I mean, the obvious jugular is oil, but the selling of oil and the need for hard currency, you can't operate without an effective banking sector. And the most recent sanctions really put the squeeze on Iran and on the business community. I don't think that's going to elicit an Iranian response along the lines that the West is hoping for, but it certainly increases the internal pressure. We've had also just the other day news of reports of an explosion in a nuclear plant in and around or not far from Isfahan. The Iranians must feel themselves under siege internally and externally as well.
Well, there was the explosion at the missile testing launching site where they lost the Revolutionary Guard Corps general, I think, in charge of their missile program.
That's right. So this is now the second such event that is perceived as, I'm sure, even if they deny it, as internal sabotage.
So it's reasonable then to assume that this isolated and paranoid theocratic regime is even getting more paranoid? Is that?
Well, it has enemies. and it does things that, it does things. The most recent IAEA report, depending on who you talk to, offers some pretty damning evidence in terms of Iran's pursuit of weaponization. So, the Iranians find themselves increasingly under diplomatic and economic assault from the West. And while the Russians are and the Chinese have not supported new sanctions through the vehicle of the UN, other sanctions have been imposed by the EU and so on. And this is really taking a toll on Iran's economy, which was not in particularly good shape to begin with.
And then, just in terms of their political influence, it looks like they're going to lose Syria, right? In terms of that being
that's a good point. I mean, here you've got not only Turkey, essentially aligned against the Syrian government, against Assad, but you've got the Arab League, which has imposed its own sanctions. which probably will not hurt that much because Iraq, among others, is not participating in them. But symbolically, the isolation of Syria in the Arab world during the against the backdrop of the Arab Spring and the drive for democratization really puts Iran in an isolated position regionally, when it, just a year ago or less, felt it was riding a wave of popularity and influence in the region.
Well, Dan Brunberg, I spoke to a member, a senior member of the Syrian opposition recently, who's in charge of their foreign affairs department, and he said that he blamed the influence that Iran has over the Iraqi government for their position on voting against the sanctions.
Well, I mean, I think there's no doubt that the Iraqi government's position, part of it is influenced by Iran and the close relationship between the ruling political elite and the Iranian government. I think that's absolutely the case. There are other factors that are involved, including business opportunities and a very vibrant, despite everything, a business community, a Sunni business community in Syria that wants to and has been very eager to pursue trade with Iraq. But I think that's secondary to the political strategic sort of factors that explain why Iraq is not supporting sanctions on Syria.
But Dan Brunberg, I imagine that this Revolutionary Guard Corps kind of government that's run by the Supreme Leader, and apparently his son has a lot of influence, and he's closely connected to the Guard Corps. Hillary Clinton referred to this government as a kind of military coup at the time after the elections were essentially stolen. Give us a sense of obviously they're paranoid from within as well as being squeezed from without. What happened to the Green Movement, and who were these so-called students that? Because it seems like one hand doing one thing and the other hand, in as much as the foreign ministry condemned the attacks, but it looks as though somebody else, you know, encouraged them.
Well, the foreign ministry has very little autonomous influence over Iranian foreign policy to begin with. And as far as I can tell from the videos of the attack on the British embassy in Tehran, that this was organized by the CG mobilization forces linked to and part of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. And I do think it reminds us again of the increasing influence of the security apparatus over the politics of the country, the success they've had in shutting out the Green Movement since the presidential elections of June 2009. I think it's premature to conclude that this whole system has been permanently securitized or militarized, and we're dealing with a new kind of Iran, as the as our Secretary of State put it. This may be the evolution of the system. There's still a lot of fluidity in the Iranian political system and resistance, particularly in the conservative camp, and of course tremendous friction between Ahmadinejad and the Supreme Leader. So there's a lot of political contentious politics, as we say in academia, and political struggles. But it unfolds against the background of the effort of the Supreme Leader, backed by the Rev Guards, the Revolutionary Guards, to increasingly centralize power. That is absolutely the case.
Well, Dan Brunberg, I remember talking some time back at the with George Kennan, the famous American diplomat, Mr. X, responsible for the famous memo that shaped the Cold War doctrine. And I spoke with him about the Iranian takeover during the Carter administration. It was some time after that. And I had heard that he had said he had advised the government, the Carter administration, to label what happened as causa belli, and to declare war on Iran at the time, and the Carter administration weren't at all interested. So I asked him about this, and he said, "Yes, indeed, that was his advice." He didn't mean that you would pull the trigger, but he thought that they had crossed the line, the Iranians, in international law, and that you had to acknowledge it. You didn't have to act on it, but you had to acknowledge it. What's your reaction to that?
Well, once you acknowledge it, it puts you in a position of being under pressure to act in ways that you may not be prepared to act. I've been reading reviews of the latest biography about Kennan, and it certainly seems that this kind of advice goes against his sort of his focus, certainly with the Soviet Union, on containment and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, that's an extraordinary story. Certainly, the United States has been in a cold war with Iran for all these years, and occasionally it's turned into a hot war. But it's never. I don't think either side has sought military confrontation until this day, and I don't think that's changed either.
Well, it does, though, lead you to ask, is this a different kind of regime? Because we treat it differently. The world treats it differently, particularly the West, vis-a-vis nuclear weapons. We live with the Pakistanis. We live with the North Koreans. But we can't live with Iran having a nuclear weapon. And particularly on the Israeli side, they suggest that this regime simply cannot be trusted. So when they do things like violate international law and take embassies hostage, or in this case, sack an embassy, doesn't it play into that scenario?
Yes, and I think you put your finger on the main issue, and that is one of trust or the lack thereof and the perceptions of Iranian intentions, which are invariably bad, and Iranians do a lot to earn that distrust. I also think that the question of Israel, Iran's position on the existence of the Jewish state, has very much played into to the perception that an Iran that was armed with nuclear weapons would be of a greater danger than one without them. So it definitely plays into this. I also think we have to recognize that we have a Cold War history with Iran. It goes back to 1979, the humiliation of the United States and the hostage incident. There's a great deal of, if you like, psychological resistance to
right. Well, there's
always anything else, but a problem.
Well, you could go back. Surely you go back to Mossadegh, don't you? Isn't that still a great wound in the polity of Iran?
Yes, and the Iranians are, and that of course helps to explain why. I mean, the Iranians have a particular issue with Britain, and this dates back to the Mossadegh era and his efforts to nationalize the Iranian oil industry and so on, hostility towards Britain. But in fact, it predates that, and theories of British influence and the conspiracy theory are rife in Iran. And you know, in many respects, Britain is a envisioned enemy is more important to that kind of paranoid psyche than the United States, and you know, we see this played into the whole storming of the British embassy here too. But Iranians have a reason, and it's not based merely on perception or irrational fears. A reason to be concerned about internal influence and meddling. Having said that, the great paradox is they keep doing things which sort of invite that very meddling. There's this kind of love hate relationship, this disdain for the West, this constant denunciation of meddling, yet a behavior that seems to almost invite that kind of meddling and that kind of treatment of Iran, almost a symbiotic relationship between those two sort of dynamics.
Well, the Ayatollah Khomeini was locked in many ways in a different century as a cleric. He for example, he referred to when he was obviously opposed to Jimmy Carter, but he seemed to I know that in one of his speeches he referred to as the German Carter, the American Carter, thinking that the word Carter meant foreign leader. A lot of people said that he really didn't have any kind of worldly outlook. And given this, this is such a theocratic regime. Do the current the supreme leader, who has absolute power, does he have any kind of sophistication about the world?
Perhaps in some respects, a notch above. He's proven adept both internally, that's for sure, and externally in many ways, given his own interests. But having said that, I think he has a very limited worldview as well, very limited exposure to anything outside of the direct circle of the kinds of people he's been surrounded by all his life. And I think that definitely affects Iran's foreign policy. And also, I think you have to recognize that there's been a change of elites in Iran over the past few years, a rise of an elite whose roots are in the provincial areas, who don't have very little exposure to the West and experience overseas, and this plays into it as well. And you have to remember that the Islamic Revolution was made by revolutionaries, many of whom had spent extensive time in England, France, and of all places, Texas. who had a sense of the world.
Sure.
This rising elite that is linked to the Revolutionary Guards right. doesn't have.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Dan Brunberg.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Brunberg, who's professor of the Department of Government at Georgetown University. He also serves as senior advisor to the Center of Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And his books include Conflict, Identity and Reform in the Muslim World and Reinventing Khomeini, the Struggle for Reform in Iran. His latest book is U.S. Policy and the Arab World. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Russell McKiber, the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. He also wrote On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He's been visiting a lot of the Occupy sites, particularly in the D.C. area, where there are two competing sites, one that is allegedly being taken over by the Democratic Party operatives, although that wasn't entirely clear of who they were and how successful they were being. But we talked largely about, will the message, particularly the powerful message of the 99% versus the 1%, outlast the movement and translate in electoral politics? And he felt that there had to be some political translation. He obviously does not support the Democratic Party and would like an alternative, but recognizes the nature of America's two-party system, making it very difficult for a third party to emerge, and just quite how the politics and the political energy of the Occupy movement will be translated. He wasn't sure, but he felt that at least starting at the precinct level, at the grassroots level, the activists should start working the politics of this country without, you know, obviously being specific. But clearly, if the grassroots movements at least began, he felt that that would have a huge impact. Then we talked with Adele Stan, who's a Washington Bureau Chief for Alternet. Always find her amusing. She's been covering the Tea Party from the beginning and their favorite son, Herman Cain, who just had the latest bimbo eruption with a fifth woman coming forth. She felt that he was toast, largely because, unlike Newt Gingrich, who confessed to adultery, which is a sin, it's in one of the 10th commandments, Cain keeps, you know, denying, and that's not going to play with the religious right. You've got to call for redemption, which he's not doing. And they control the primaries in South Carolina, and particularly the first one in Iowa. So he probably will pull out. But still, let's face it, at least he's been entertaining compared to the rest of them. And then I talked with Dan Brunberg, a specialist on Iran, about the so-called Iranian students taking over the British embassy, which they called a den of spies, and chanting death to England. Of course, that has echoes of what happened back in Carter's day with the 444 days of hostage taking. He felt that they weren't students, that they were the besieged militia, a part of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and that indeed this is a paranoid regime, but he said they have reason to be paranoid. A lot of people are out to get them, and the West is tightening the screws, and they're losing their influence in Syria, and they don't play by the normal rules, and they strike out in these kind of ways. We can expect more of it. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.